to Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from Tan Talk Radio Network Studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Oh, wow, this is a very special day. Jerome Preisler is a best-selling author of almost 40 books, and he's been on the program several times ever since I met him at BoucherCon in Dallas. And, of course, we have been speaking about his wonderful books in the NetForce series created by Tom Clancy and Steve Pachnik. And the last two books that we talked about were Dark Web and Attack Protocol, all wonderful New York Times best-selling books. But today, I am so thrilled to have him back to talk about a book that we discussed a few weeks ago called Civil War Commando, William Cushing and the Daring Raid to Sink the Ironclad CSS Albemarle. Now, I'm thinking of this today, this program, it's a very special day because it is when I get a book that is Pulitzer Prize worthy. It is really exciting. And so I am so happy to welcome Jerome back to the program. Hi, Jerome.
Happy New Year, Patsy, with a Z.
Thank you. Okay, well, as I said, you know, you are the only author I've had on like three times in a row in quick succession because, as I told you last time we spoke, I found Civil War Commando to be such a inspiring book, such a thrilling book, that I just wanted to give my listeners an opportunity to hear a little bit more about the process that you went through. It's always so exciting when you come across an idea, you know, for a novelist, you finally come out with a character that you want to run with. But in your case, you found a real life character. And it's funny, we have here in St. Petersburg the Admiral Farragut School, a military school. It's a wonderful school, and many of the astronauts have actually gone through that school. So I drive past it quite often, and now every time I see it, I think of Will Cushing and this wonderful man that you've discovered and that you're bringing back to life for so many people because he was largely forgotten.
And, of course, David Farragut, first admiral of the Navy, called Will the hero of the Civil War. So it's just an interesting little factoid.
It is, and it's very exciting that you have, you know, written this book. It's so beautifully written. Of course, you have all this wonderful talent. I think I already crowned you the king of techno thrillers.
I wear the crown.
Yes.
Proudly.
And you deserve it because I can tell you, every time I get one of your books, I'm like, it's a wonderful, wonderful, exciting read. But with this book, it's real. It's real. And as I'm, even from the first page, I'm reading it and I'm saying, this is real. How lucky you were to come across somebody so fascinating.
Yeah, you know, what you're saying is really on point because when I look for a subject to write about, in a nonfiction subject, everything I write is generally character-driven, so I'm looking for an interesting personality. And, you know, it's not always easy to find someone, especially when a character is of some historical importance and he's a colorful character. One would expect that he's been written about extensively, or at least to some degree, so that it makes it, you don't want to just, you know, cover territory somebody else has mined. And I found that with Will, I was fortunate that wasn't the case. The same qualities that make Will interesting to me are the very sorts of things that I try to build into a character when I'm writing a novel. So it's almost as if somebody, you know, as if I was handed this gift of a character that I don't have to create, I don't have to build. He's all there for me. He he vividly comes to life. And you know, one thing, Patsy, that I don't think we've discussed that was running through my mind because I knew kind of what the you know, what the focus of our conversation would be, and that's that when I started writing the book and was doing the research, there were two characters that I had in mind as kind of splitting the focus, and one was Will, and one was a guy named Gilbert Elliot, who built the ironclad CSS Albemarle that ultimately Will attacks and destroys in the climax of the book. But I thought because they were of similar age, both very young men, 18, 19, 20 years old, both kind of laying everything on the line, I thought it would be almost 50-50, where I was playing one character against the other, and I thought that was going to be the structure of the book. But Will just took it over. He was so audacious, so gallant, so fearless, and just this kind of, you know, knight in shining armor like character that he ran away with the book. So that was a bit unexpected for me.
He certainly is a bigger than life character, and it's so exciting the way you have written this book. As you said, you know, Elliot's important, but from page one, anybody who reads this, it just grabs you, and it's at a very early age for Will, but you become attached to this child at first, and then the young man that he becomes, and all of this excitement that happens at such a young age. When you look around at sort of teenagers today and you say, what are they doing? Like, you can't imagine that somebody as young as Will could do such amazing things and have such amazing character.
And I think, don't hold me to this, but I think obviously people grew up a lot faster in those days. So, you know, 19 or 20 in 1860 or 1861 or 2 is a lot different than the same age, not just in 2020 or 2021, but even, you know, in growing up in the 50s, 60s, 70s. But I think even for someone at that young in the Civil War, I think that he was pretty exceptional. I just think that he was exceptional no matter what the age is, but I certainly think that even for a mature 19-year-old in the Civil War, Will was, just a wild character. So, yeah, I agree with you. He just is irresistible, and once I learned a little bit about him, the only question was, the two questions were, had anyone written anything along the lines that I wanted to, and the answer was no, and then it was, could I find a publisher, and obviously the answer to that was yes.
Well, let's take a step back, and let's start with Gilbert Elliot, and because explain why this ship that he created, explain the importance of it, and the damage that it was doing to during the Civil War.
Well, the backdrop to the whole thing is that America entered the Civil War in 1860-61, at the time, both what would become the Union Navy and the Confederate Navy were looking for ways to kind of change the face of naval warfare. And what they saw was the potential of ironclad ships. Prior to that time, naval combat had been conducted between wooden ships. That was the technology. And probably a few years before that, in the 1840s or 1830s, France and maybe England, but I think it was just France, actually, began building ironclad warships. They were the first in Europe. And so the Secretary of the Confederate Navy, a guy named Mallory, and the Secretary of the Union Navy were both kind of in an arm in a technology race to see who could build the first ironclad. And again, if you can just, it's pretty easy to see what kind of damage they can do when the opposing force, their naval fleets consisted of wooden ships, and here you had this gigantic Leviathan, 260, 265 feet long, a crew of about 150. It was just armored from stem to stern in iron plating, heavily armed, and it had, and the CSS Albemarle was called a ram, because that's what it was. It had a huge ram in front of it. It looked like a giant tusk, and that was its principal weapon. It would just plow right through opposing vessels. So with that, when Elliot, who was the person who built the ship, through a lot of trials and hardships, and got it done for the Confederacy, once they had that ship at their disposal, and had it sitting outside Plymouth Harbor, and threatening the whole the waterways around the Virginias, Carolinas, the Union needed to destroy it. They were powerless against it.
Well, it was truly a monster, and it must have terrified the Union ships, as you said, made of wood, and they come up against something that is so formidable. You can't hit it. Whatever cannon they used would just bounce off of it. It was a frightening experience for the Union troops.
Yeah, in fact, Will, of course, ends up launching a commando raid against it after a number of months, and he's successful. But before that, the Union fleet that was sent against it was totally destroyed. There was a fleet of about five ships that were sent to destroy it just months earlier, and three of them were total. They were completely sunk. The crews were, many dozens of men were killed, including a guy named Commander Charles Flusser, who was the commander of the blockading squadron that was sent to destroy it, and Will Cushing's mentor. This guy was a seasoned old soul. He was a longtime naval warrior, and it just destroyed him. And in fact, when Will, in one little dramatic twist, when Will goes to destroy it, it's literally sitting right behind the carcass of the ship that Flusser was on when he fought it. It had sunk it, and it just went right down in the harbor, and it was being used kind of as a barricade against attack. It kind of gives you a sense of how devastating, a vessel and a weapon the Albemarle was.
Well, I love that at the end of the book you have a really enormous, massive bibliography of all the books and documents that you used for your research. Tell us a little bit about how you started your research and conducted it, because you had to actually read some original documents. As you said, this story wasn't widely published. We didn't know a lot about it before, and you certainly came out with a lot of information and a new angle on things because of the research.
Yeah, that's a great point. Ideally, you always try for that. At least I do, and obviously, you don't want to rehash something that's been written, and you want to have your own perspective and so on. So the more what they call primary source material, which would be what you just alluded to, combat records, in this case, because we're talking about a war story. So combat records, both historical records, both sides, you know, Confederate, Union. Will was a prolific letter writer, and he was very colorful. So, and fortunately, a lot of them have been preserved. Both, he collected them in his lifetime. So there were a number of them that were available in a little volume that he put together. And then there are others that are in private collections and others that were printed in newspapers. And then what I just looked at in this book, and I had a lot of access to it, was both what I just mentioned, of course, the combat records, post battle reports that are prepared all the time by whatever service you're researching. So in this case, if I was looking at a battle, since it was all of this is in our National Archives, I was able to get both the Confederate side of the battle and the Union side of the battle, which is really fantastic. You know, that's not always the case. If you're writing about World War II, you might get you'll get the U.S. World War II records or the British, but a lot of the German records were destroyed, so you don't really have their reports. I had all of that. I had Will's letters, and then another thing that really became a great resource for me was old contemporaneous newspapers. So I was able to, for example, if there was a battle I could look at the military records, the naval records, and I wasn't quite sure about something that I read in them, I could actually look at the dates and then look up different newspapers from that period and see what the newspaper accounts was, and kind of, like, as you do when you're writing history, put together the puzzle and see, well, okay, this, you have to, sometimes it's a judgment call. This is inaccurate, this isn't. But and you try to put together the most cohesive and coherent version of events. So newspapers were great. And another thing that was great about reading old newspapers, and I read a ton of them, again, both Southern and Northern newspapers, was I was able to really get, irrespective of the story about Will, I was able to get a real feel for what people were going through in the time building up to and during the Civil War. You know, reading letters to the editor, reading editorials, and then even looking at stuff like advertisements. I even, in the book, I have one section where I write about what's in the newspaper one day, and I actually throw in a bunch of really interesting and quaint advertisements that were in the newspaper, because I think it gives you a color of the time and a feel for it. So all of that was firsthand stuff. And one last thing I would add, I don't want to go on about this, but there were war correspondents then as there are now. The difference was that they were unfortunately anonymous in those days. So say the New York Herald or the New York Times sent a correspondent aboard a ship that Will was commanding when it went into battle. These journalists from that period were really, a lot of them were great writers. You know, they had really beautiful, colorful prose, and that really gave me a sense of the actions I'm writing about and what everything looked like, and as well as kind of rubbing off on the style I used, which was a lot more formal than my usual style. And I tried to kind of give it the flavor of something that might have been written sometime shortly after the Civil War.
Well, you certainly did. And that was one of the things that I found so interesting, that they had embeds. You know, after the Gulf War, we started hearing about embeds, you know, those reporters who were put there. And, of course, many of them made big names for themselves and got great book deals. But in those days, they had embeds. They had people who were reporters who were there with him. And this is why, thanks to them, that you were able to, I think, get such an exciting story and details that we didn't know about I'm sure most people had no idea. You sort of think of Civil War ships fighting out there in the water somewhere. You never, ever think about them actually, that the sailors would get off the ships and would actually go inland and do some fighting and do some reconnaissance inland. And that's what makes this book so exciting.
Yeah, he would, when we talked about the book the first time, Will would do anything. He would lead a small party ashore against, a whole Confederate troop contingent to raid a town, raid the post office, kidnap a general. there were no bounds.
I know, and, it's so exciting.
Yeah, and usually he would come aboard with two small boatfuls of men, so maybe there'd be, 15 men a boat, so maybe it'd be anywhere between 15 and 30 men against whoever he would encounter there. It's not like he had, satellite recon. So, and in general, when I would talk about the book, when I was writing it or even after, people really don't think about the naval aspect of the Civil War that much, It's more, everybody knows about the Merrimack, and there's certain things that people remember. But I don't think a lot of people really, there hasn't been that much focus on all of the naval action that took place during that time. I thought it was very interesting.
And the thing is, because it hasn't been really written about, and certainly not in this way, you have this mental picture, the ships, we hear about the blockades and, we know, of course, the importance of supplies coming from overseas and how we're stopping the unions, we're stopping the Confederates from shipping cotton because they didn't want them to get money. And, we have that sort of vague thing, but we imagine the captain of the ship up there, up there just, steering the ship. And you don't imagine it. I'm sure no one really, I can't think of anyone who would know that, yes, actually there were captains who just say, okay, let's get in there. Let's tango, let's get in there. And that's what makes this so exciting. And so it stands out, this book. That's why when I read it and I'm thinking to myself, I've read a lot of Pulitzer Prize winning books. And, some of them are really fascinating. They're fun. But sometimes they're just not, they just don't grab you. They're worthy, because the author's done great research or something. But very seldom does a book just grab you like this book. And so you've accomplished two things. You've done the research worthy of winning a Pulitzer Prize, and then you've done the research worthy of making this into a bestseller, and I hope a film, or a streaming video, because I think this would be more exciting even than John Adams, the wonderful streaming video they did with this, because this is so exciting. There's so many aspects of Will's life that just, it was made for the screen.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Another thing about the book is that I really didn't know for sure how much of it, in terms of, would it be a third or a half or whatever, would be devoted to the raid again on the CSS Albemarle, which is the subtitle, Will Cushing, Civil War Commander, Will Cushing's raid and Will Cushing's raid against the CSS Albemarle, or something like that. I don't even know the title.
The daring raid to sink the ironclad CSS Albemarle.
But thank you. But I lost my train of thought there. But Will's life and all of these other escapades were so really great and full of action and excitement and his whole, his whole youth, that it ends up that it really became, Will's story, as I mentioned earlier. It, of course, the Albemarle is the climax, and we build up to it. I build up to it, but it's really Will's life. And Yeah, you know, I think that it's been, you know, because I obviously write a lot of thrillers, I think that over time I've been able to really apply all of the kinds of dramatic techniques that I do to fiction to my nonfiction, and I think that having done a few, hopefully you get a little bit better as you get older and as you've done it more. So I think the timing was just right when I hit Will's story, because I think that I was at a point where I could really bring a lot of those, you know, I really had developed a lot the techniques that were needed to tell the story in the way it should be, which is, you know, full of action, full of drama, full of character, really bring it alive. So,
and you certainly have. And the thing is, you know, there's so much to his story, because when we start, it's so funny. He's so young at this point, but he's already gone. You know, he's had problems in school. Let's put it this way. You know, it's so funny when you look at it. It's like everything was just cinematically designed for you to run with this.
He gets himself in trouble from the time he's like 9 years old, and
I know, it's,
you know, almost gets booted out of what I don't know if they called it elementary school, but gets booted out of grade school, gets into the Naval Academy at Annapolis, gets kicked out, gets a second chance, and is allowed to serve in the U.S. Navy, gets kicked out.
Everything about it.
Yeah.
And as you said, because you are so talented as a thriller writer, you have put all of that sort of passion and action and everything into this book to make a truly exciting nonfiction book into something that reads like a novel and that will film when Hollywood finally takes notice of you. Will film beautifully, and some young actor will be so thankful to you. He will thank you. He'll be a young guy, and he'll be thankful to you for 100 years because this is a part that is made. I mean, it's an actor's dream to play a hero like this man. Will Cushing is just somebody, once you read about him, and once we see him on the big screen or streaming video as it is nowadays, he's going to have his rightful place in American history, and that's thanks to you. And I think that's what, I don't know, I haven't looked at the ins and outs how they do Pulitzer Prizes, but they really should look at that you've taken a character, and people will be reading this book 100 years from now to understand the Civil War, 200 years from now. This is a book of the ages, and that's what makes it so exciting.
Yeah, I feel good about that. I really kind of, you know, I don't want to sound corny or sugary about this, but I feel very privileged that I can write books like this. And when I can bring into people's awareness the life of somebody like this, or, you know, before this, the nonfiction book I did was a book called First to Jump, and that was about the men of a certain group of men from the 101st Airborne and 82nd Airborne during World War II. And one of the most gratifying things, of course, that's more recent, so I would get letters from the grandchildren or the children of some of the men I'd written about, and telling me, wow, you know, it was great to read about my dad. It was, and I would correspond with them and find out, you know, how their parents met in World War II and stuff like that. And it's a really great feeling. You know, you get an email like that, it makes your day, because you've commemorated someone, you've honored someone, and you've filled a little, some small space in history that's, you know, that needed to be filled.
You've done it with this book. I think that, you know, everyone, I want all of my listeners, if you, this book is for everyone. It's a wonderful book, and I'm telling you, get this book. It's just something about it. When you read it, you will feel better afterwards. You will be inspired. It's wonderful to know that there are people who can be, you know, heroes, and that it doesn't matter. Perhaps along the way you make some mistakes, but boy, oh boy, when your time comes to become a hero, you can really do it. And Jerome, I think this book is wonderful, and I'm very honored, you know, to have spoken to you again. And I want you to tell, make sure that as soon as you get a movie deal, you let me know, and that you're back on Joy on Paper so we can talk about it, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, well, Jerome Preisler, you are an amazing author, and it's been an honor to talk to you today.
It's always a pleasure to be here, and our first conversation of the new year.
Exactly. And I hope, I'm sure there'll be another book coming out soon, so you can come back again.
I just finished one today.
Okay, well, congratulations, and happy new year. What a way to start the new year with a new book. As soon as you have a pub date, you let me know, okay?
Rightio.
Okay. Bye-bye, Nitro. Bye. Oh, wow. Okay, well, you know, we're going to go straight over. We'll skip commercials right now because I got talking to Jerome there. And I get to talk to somebody. Oh, my goodness. I am so happy to have her back. She is like one of the luckiest women in the world. And I'm lucky to talk to her. Trudy Truitt. Hi, Trudy.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, wow. I'm excited. You know, I just... Oh, when I get one of these books, Explore Academy, it is, you know, the minute I open it up, I say, I don't care what else I'm doing. I become a kid again. I just have to jump in. This is now with the fifth book, and I love this series so much. And I keep thinking about, well, I think Nat Geo, anybody who works for Nat Geo is so lucky because you are around the greatest people in the world.
Yes.
And it must be such a thrill for you. And then for you to be writing these wonderful books. Explore Academy is someplace. I want to be a teenager. I want to go. Please. Please let me go. I want to be. It's so much fun. The books are so much fun. And they're so beautiful. I'm holding it up to the camera because we're also on YouTube. The quality of these books is so wonderful. It's so intelligent. The paper quality, they're hefty books, the covers, everything, and all of the beautiful illustrations. I just love them.
Yeah, they are really spectacular. The covers have the overlay on them, so you have the raised print. They've spared no expense at just making them really special, really beautiful.
And I think that kids who get these books will... I think having a quality book in your hand gives you a different sense of the importance of it. And having this book, it would be a thrill. When I was young, if I would have had a book like this, I would have been just overwhelmed with excitement. Yeah. And, of course, then you have this wonderful job. I mean, I hate to call it a job. I mean, you actually get paid.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to complain about being able to write an adventure story and talk to explorers from around the world and do all this wonderful research and get to combine it with my imagination. There's no downside here.
And the new book, The Tiger's Nest, is so exciting. And it leads us on a fascinating story, I tell you that. I love Cruz Coronado. I love them all. I love Sailor. I can't decide who I love, which characters I love the most. And, of course, Emmett and Brandis, and they're all following, you know, looking for the clues to Cruz's mother, Cypher. So why don't you sort of lay it out, what this book is about, and then we'll talk about some of the scientists behind.
Oh, sure. So this is actually the fifth book in the Explorer Academy series, if your listeners aren't familiar with it. I started it, the first book came out 2 years ago, And it is the continuing adventures of a young explorer led by Cruz Coronado. He's 12 years old, as are most of the explorers. And they travel the world learning about things like pollution, climate change, extinction, and then also learning about what they might want to do as they become adults. So that's really what Cruz's main focus is, going to school. And they're traveling and they're circumnavigating the globe. But at the same time, Cruz is also looking for pieces of a cipher that his mother left behind for him to find. She was a scientist. She died under mysterious circumstances, and she was creating a special formula that would help mankind. And so, knowing that her life was in danger, she engraved the formula into stone, split the stone into pieces, and then hid them around the world for Cruz to find. So he's on this side mission, traveling along with the explorers. So basically, this is the fifth book in this series, and in this particular book, the explorers are traveling through the Indian Ocean. So they are learning about things like coral reef farming and sea turtle conservation and habitat restoration, as well as Cruz is still trying to find now. In this book, he gets to find two pieces of the cipher. So he gets to find...
No, you can't tell. You can't tell. No. That's enough. That's enough.
Okay.
They're going to find that, and they're going to find so. It's just everything about this book. All of the things they do. I want to be there with them.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because some people do ask me, is there a real Explorer Academy? And I say, not yet.
Well, you know, National Geographic can afford it. They can build this thing, and I want to be embedded as a reporter.
That's the whole point too, is that I want to make it a fun adventure for kids. So I want them to enjoy learning about science and understanding that, you know, science isn't a boring, you know, textbook type of thing that you read about it in a book or you are stuck in a lab. That is not what science is at all. The National Geographic explorers are traveling the world. They're doing research. They're doing important work. And of course, they're enjoying what they do. There's a lot of
and they get paid for it. They get paid.
They get paid.
Isn't it funny? When you think about, I would do that for nothing, and then they get paid.
Yeah, and it's tough work. But like any job, they are well prepared for what they do. You know, they get a good education. They learn their trade. They learn their craft. And they're bringing back research and information that we need to know to protect the planet, you know, to make a difference, to advance technology. So while it's adventuring and great fun, there's a purpose behind it. And I want kids to understand that, too. It's not just thrills and chills for the sake of it. There is a reason why they do what they do, and it's to better mankind.
And by developing these wonderful characters that kids can relate to, and then bringing them together with scientists who explain things to them and that they work with and they help, it just makes for such an exciting adventure. And I can't decide which adventure I love the most, because I'd like to do them all. I'd like to go. I would just like, to see the whales. And I live here in on the Gulf Coast, so we have turtles, season of turtles where all of the, they surround the turtle nestings with protective shields around them so that people won't, disturb them. And of course, we had to keep our lights off at night during the turtle season. Because it's important that kids understand that, for inland kids who have no idea of what it means, that we're always excited here when turtles, the turtle season comes. And it's so important that kids have this excitement about saving the planet, about saving animals and the coral reef and all of that. It's just, it's wonderful the way that you engage the reader.
Well, and I think it's important, for them to know that this is, while I do use my imagination in creating, interesting technology and and things for them to do. The truth is this is very real. You know, they, what the explorers do and where they go and how they contribute is something that kids can grow up to do. So if they do have a passion for sea turtles or whales or animals or habitats of any type, the environment, they can take their passion and make it a career.
And, you know, I'm not always sure which technology is real and which isn't in your books.
Well, and here's the fun thing about that, too, is, yes, I will admit that there are times that I push the envelope. And so because I am a big Star Trek fan and science fiction fan, so I do push it. But what's kind of amazing is that much of the technology in the book is actually real. You know, like the little drone that Cruz has, there are tiny, small drones that size that are, Cruz has a honeybee drone. And they're, while she does more than your typical drone, she's almost like another character in the book. There are small, little, tiny drones. And they're, the technology that is in the book is actually does exist. While we may not be able to, you know, change the color of our coat or our clothing with our by using our mind, there are self-assembling materials out there. MIT has a self-assembly lab where they're learning, they're actually creating materials that will assemble themselves. So imagine a tent that can put itself together, you know, triggered by temperature or wind or, you know, weather. So, you know, this technology does exist. I just maybe, you know, tweaked it a little, it pushed the envelope a little there, but it would not surprise me if down the road, you know, somebody were to pick up Explore Academy.
Well, exactly.
And go, I already know that.
They're going to say, uh-oh, Trudy Truitt invented that.
Well, and if we think about, you know, technology back in the 60s and 70s, if you go back and look at the old Star Trek episodes, that's a great example.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they have these handheld camcorders, recorders, they have communicators. We have cell phones we walk around with now. We couldn't even imagine that 60 years ago.
I know. It's so exciting that you can just run wild with it, and maybe technology and all those scientists out there will have to catch up with Trudy. They'll say,
well, you know, that's the thing is I think I'm catching up with them, because as I was doing research for this, I thought I was making, you know, I'm imagining coming up with great technology, and then I realized, oh, they're already working on
somebody's
that.
Okay.
I'm not as creative as I thought I was. It's great fun to be able to do that. And I, you know, hope that as kids read this, they understand that, you know, the cutting edge technology, again, is something that they can get involved with. They can learn to do. They can have that as a career.
And maybe they will take more interest in STEM because...
I hope so. Yeah, you know, and I think kids are interested. They're fascinated. You know, I used to write both fiction and nonfiction. I kind of crossed more into the fiction realm. But for the longest time, I wrote nonfiction library books. So I would write books on volcanoes and earthquakes and earth science and weather. And kids are really fascinated by those topics. You just have to, you know, understand that science can be fun. It is interesting. It is fascinating. And kids want to learn about it.
And having books like this, I think, will do so much good for kids because there was a point, I think, and I'm telling you, when I was sort of in school, all the school books were so boring, so horribly boring. It was painful. I was just like in constant agony because the books were so bad. And that kids can now have a book like this. And I love at the end of the book how you highlight and really show off the real people and have their pictures in the book and talk about them, like Michael Lombardi and Salome Ursula Bugless, all of this, these people, they get the recognition that they need. And I think young people can say, well, yeah, you know, I might do something like this and I'm going to be recognized for my work.
Right, right. And it's important to see that, you know, you can take a passion that you have for anything, you know, nature, science, animals, and translate that into a productive career that really contributes. And yes, so in the back of each book, there are profiles of different scientists. Many of them inspired the actual storyline in the book. And so kids can read about that. And then they can also read about what's real and what isn't, so that they do know which technology in the book is inspired by actual science. And ExplorerAcademy.com, the website, they can go to that, and there are some wonderful videos there done by the explorers themselves. They're very short, 2 to 3 minute videos that kids and teachers can watch, and then you can see, oh, so this is what a glacier expert does. This is what a climatologist does. And get a feel for what a day in the life of an explorer is.
Well, I even little things like the Osh, which is a portable life support tent that I didn't know about. All of these things, I was just so thrilled to find. I love books that when I finish a book, I know something more. I knew, you know, and it's
right.
So exciting. And you write so beautifully. The books are just... just on their own as adventure stories, because you have a bad guy, you have some nebulous spies, and you have some thing.
Right.
Yeah, you have some things to move that story along. We always need that to make an exciting adventure. And so the books are exciting adventures. The illustrations, you just want to stop and look at them and imagine yourself there. I want to be 12 years old. I want to be, and I just want to encourage everyone, please, if you have any children in your life, this is wonderful. And it's from young children to teenagers, high school kids. Really, high school kids should read this, because so many of their books are boring, and that it turns them off of science, off of reading, off of everything, and they need right. books like this. So I think that Trudy Truitt, I love your name too. I get such a kick out of that name. And the new book is the Explore Academy, The Tiger's Nest. Again, where can they go? What website?
You can head on over to my website, which is truditruitt.com. It's truditruitt.com. And you can also check out ExploreAcademy.com.
ExploreAcademy.com.
Yes.
Oh, and then as soon as National Geographic puts a little money behind it and builds, until then, I have to wait for the next book. And when it arrives, I know that I'm going to stop everything in the house, and I'm going to sit down and be a kid again and just enjoy Explorers Academy and think of you. And just, I'm so thrilled that you get paid to do this.
Yeah, it's a good life.
It's a great life.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to National Geographic. I tell everyone that when they want to, now it's of course difficult to visit people, but if you want to do something really nice for people, and Valentine's Day is coming up, the best gifts in the world are books. And there is a National Geographic book just perfect for everybody in your family. And if you have any young people in your family, get them the Explore Academy books, and they will thank you forever. Okay?
Oh, thank you so much. That's terrific.
Okay, so everybody, remember, Nat Geo, the perfect gift for everybody. And thank you, Trudy, for being on Joy on Paper today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Oh, wow. I love this book. Oh my goodness. I want all these adventures. I want to travel with these kids. I want to do all of these exciting things. Oh, and Cruz Coronado is a big surfer, and there's surfing. There's everything. All the deep sea diving. Very exciting. It's a very exciting book. And I know it's supposed to be for kids. Well, the marketing for kids, but definitely teenagers should have this book, because it will give them an idea of some of the occupations that they might take and study in school and get good paying degrees and good paying jobs with Nat Geo. Wow. It's like that has to be a dream job come true, because once you're with Nat Geo, you have all these exciting people to work with and all these exciting books that they write. Wow. there are a lot of times, authors like, whoa, where am I going to go? If you can hook yourself up with Nat Geo, you have made it for life, because they are just fun people. And I've always been so grateful for all of the books that they send me, because, as I said, Thanksgiving Day should be a national Nat Geo Day, because it is the time to give a book to someone that you love. And, of course, now with Valentine's Day, there are some wonderful, wonderful, thrilling books for sort of every subject. But I love particularly books about Africa, and all of the books about women and empowerment. And there's just so many books in the Nat Geo Library. And I love Nat Geo Kids website. I look at it every morning, because they always have an interesting animal or an interesting little factoid, something sort of I can think about for the rest of the day. And Nat Geo Kids is a wonderful website. Just put it on instead of the news. You don't need the news. We don't need the news. We just need to have a few minutes every day where we start our day off right. And I highly recommend that, because everything else is like, oh, too much. I don't know what's going on in this world. I want to say a special hello to my brother, who has 7 degrees weather right now, and it is snowing. It is snowing in Berga, Michigan, and I don't miss it. I was born in a blizzard, and I don't miss it at all. We had a little bit of cold weather here in Florida, and that was enough for me. It reminded me of why I don't miss snow. But I want to say a special hello to him, because he loves it. He, you know, this is what he looks forward to every year. More snow and more snow. I think he had, 900 inches last year or something. How can you have 900 inches of snow? It's crazy. But he's probably just laughing his head off, looking at and running out to the sauna. Yeah, that's the life in northern Michigan. Anyway, you know, everybody, I again want to tell you that one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, a streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel. And that's what I'm hoping for some of the many wonderful authors that I've spoken to in the past few months. Certainly for Jerome Preisler, his book should be a major motion picture. And of course, Carol J. Perry, her Witch City Mysteries should be on the Hallmark Channel. A wonderful series. I'm telling you, I'm tired of all the reruns. It's time they needed some fresh material. Look at Carol J. Perry. Now that would make a heck of a series. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed. Thank you. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. Whoa, whoa, whoa. I should have been a general. Oh, maybe I should have been an admiral. I would have been. Oh, but they don't let you fight anybody anymore. Anyway, but I could have ordered people around. Anyway, have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. Read a book and order a Nat Geo book. It'll make you happy. Bye-bye now.